Hey guys, let's face it, you're probably listening to this show and all of your other shows on your phone or pad. Are you tired of filling them up with all your favorite podcasts? Well, you stream your movies, you stream your music, why not stream your podcasts? Try Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is an app that allows you to stream over 20,000 of your favorite shows, including How Did I Get Here, right to your smartphone or pad. Download it for free at Stitcher.com or find it in your app store. I use it and I absolutely love it. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get down.
You may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a fantastic show for you guys today. Artist Bale Creek Allen is here. Yeah, Bale is an old friend of mine. He's a character that some of you might know from around Austin. His brother is Bucca Allen, the keyboard player. His parents are Terry Allen, the musician and artist. And his mother is Jo Harvey Allen, the actress and writer and artist as well. Just this whole artistic family of people that are exploding with art, okay? This guy is one of the most creative people that I've ever met. No matter what he's doing, if it's bronze sculpture, if it's painting, if it's photography, if it's neon work, if it's woodwork, if it's spoken word, if it's music, if he's playing drums, if it's theater, this guy is just a creative entity, a force of nature with an amazing energy. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. Bale Creek Allen, amazing guy, one of my favorite people. You can find him at BaleCreekAllen.com if you want to look at what he's doing before you get into this conversation, see what we're talking about. Guy's brilliant, all right? So before we get to my conversation with the brilliant Bale Creek Allen, let me tell you what's going on with me. I'm playing a Mardi Gras festival thing down in Galveston tomorrow. I guess Mardi Gras is this weekend. So I'll be down there with Skyrocket playing a thing on Saturday. If you see us, if you're down there, say hi. Come wave at me. I'm the keyboard guy over there. If you don't know what I look like, in case you just listen to the show, but you don't know what I look like this. Google me, Johnny. Images. Google images. Also, hey, I want to tell you guys that I'm playing Wednesday, February 10th at the Townsend here in Austin from 8 to 10. I'm doing a songwriter in the round with the great Sela, who's been on the show, and Tom Meaney, who's been on the show. We're going to swap songs and entertain people with stories, and we will have a special guest, Mr. John Green, on percussion, playing with all of us. So that should be a lot of fun. Sela and Tom are great songwriters and great people, and so I bet it's going to be a great time. Coming out to the Townsend in Austin, Texas, on Wednesday, February 10th, from 8 to 10, and check out me, Sela, and Tom Meaney, and the great John Green on percussion. All right? And hey, before we get to this conversation with Bale Creek Allen, I do want to tell you guys one more thing. Sorry, I'm unzipping my jacket here. I want to tell you guys one more thing. It's important that you help us share this show. There's no way, like, there's no advertising for this show. It's just all kind of like, if you like it, tell people about it. If you have social media, if you're on Facebook, like our Facebook page, and I post these shows on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Gowdy on Twitter, and our Facebook page is called How Did I Get Here? I post these shows on there. If you like one and you thought it was good, share it on your page. Let people know that you listen to this show. Let's spread the word about it and get people listening, okay? Tell them about my conversation with the great Bale Creek Allen. Great dude, great artist. We have a fantastic long conversation. I ran into him at the Pop Austin show where it was all lights, and he had done a neon installation called Crucifence, which was all these crosses making a fence. I'll post it on my Facebook page. It's actually the screensaver on my phone and has been since that night. Love Bale Creek Allen. I know you will too. I hope that you have a great weekend. Come on out and see me next Wednesday at the Townsend with Tom Meaney and Sela. And if you're not in Austin, hey, dude, do what you can. Follow the show. Share the show. All right? Let's talk to Bale Creek Allen. Amazing artist, amazing dude. Have a great weekend. Let's get down.
That's right.
That's right. How do you I was thinking, I've been thinking a lot about you today.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, check this out. You know what I always have here? These are brakes from your motorcycle. They've just
from
always,
my motor?
Yeah, you gave them to me one night at the Continental Club. You had them in your pocket. And you said, oh, those are from my motorcycle.
Holy shit. Yeah, because I remember. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's the other piece right there. For some reason, I've just always had them like on this organ since you gave them to me.
You know, oh, my God, what the hell? The guy, I wasn't riding it when these brakes, we were coming back from San Antonio.
Yeah.
And I was riding a friend's motorcycle because it was just two of us. And this guy, Freddie, needed a bike. Freddie, do you know Freddie used to live with Marie? He was married to Marie Ely. But he was in the band Razorlight, guitar player from England.
Oh, like long hair? Yeah. Freddie. I totally know that guy.
So Freddie and I go to San Antonio. And I let him use my motorcycle because I didn't want him to ride the one I was borrowing.
Right.
And so we were together, but it turns out, dude, that his brakes were barely working. I mean, this is what happened. We pulled in that night and I saw you.
And Jesus.
That was it. They just fell off the motorcycle.
That's what you said.
I was like, whoa. Sorry, Freddie.
That is fucked up, man. We're all the way just from San Antonio. Do you ride motorcycles all the time? Yeah.
Are we allowed to cuss?
Yeah.
Fucking A.
Well, so I was thinking back to when I met you, and I did, like, a lot of people that come in here that I've known since around 91 or so.
That's the year.
I can't remember actually meeting them, but you, I distinctly remember meeting because there was a party at Bucca's house, and it was before I moved here. Like a couple months. Do you remember that?
Yeah, on Eva Street, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
where we were when we... I remember meeting
you
there.
I met you, I met Jana, I met Wolfson.
Dude, it was...
It was an epic...
Well, you know, every night there was a party.
Was there?
Back then, it was kind of like... I think that was our version for our generation in this town of the Summer of Love. 91.
Yeah.
91.
Yeah.
Dude, 91, I mean... Bucca lived on Eva. When I first moved to Austin, we were directly behind the Magnolia Cafe.
Yeah.
In this brown house. And another friend of ours was next door. And then next door to that on the corner was a House Orbit where Bob Schneider and 14 other people lived. And we, you know, it was just
House
like,
in Orbit? Like the guys from that band?
House in Orbit, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I love those guys.
That's where everyone rehearsed. And it was just like shotgun style motel house.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we were all just young and, you know, yeah. I mean, fucking in college or dropped out of college, you know?
Yeah.
And so Buck moved here first. And then when I left the museum school, I pulled straight in, you know, off I-35 on Old Torf, made a left on Congress. Right where the Magnolia pulled up to Eva, and then we shared a house, and we stayed there for a while. But then we moved. I met you in the other house, which was on the other side of the boys' club.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was still on Eva.
Right.
But it was on the other side of that apartment complex.
Right.
Which is like 2020 now, or by Seaboys and all that.
Yeah.
And, but that whole summer, man, and really the whole year, but that summer... our lives revolved around the Continental Club.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
Magnolia Cafe.
Yeah.
7-Eleven.
Yeah.
Stacy Pool. Boys Club.
311.
311 Club.
Yeah.
Steamboat
yeah.
or Black Cat.
Yeah.
And the hole in the wall occasionally.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
It was just like.
And it was all the
every
people.
Night, you know, we were, you know.
Do you think it's like that for kids now? You have kids. I mean, how old is Sled?
Man, it's not like that at all for my
it's
kids.
Not.
And you know, it's I think it is for some kids, but my kids both were in private school and they were, you know, in Westlake and just exposed to a whole other world, you know, than but in general I think kids I think there's a group of kids, but no, man, I don't think Austin is the same in that way. It doesn't feel the same to me.
Right.
You know? And the kids I see, like, you know, the second generation or, you know, Willie Graham and Marlon and Sled was in a band too, you know? Sled was in a band And it was cool, and we hooked them up to kind of those same people we knew back then.
Right.
So they were playing at Antone's or at Continental. Or,
yeah, yeah.
But it just seemed like, it just seems different, man. It just, I don't think it has that same kind of, there was a magical time,
there
man.
There was a magical time.
I mean, we were all in a good zone, a good creative place. And here's the thing that's happened to Austin that really sucks about what has changed. And there's elements about Austin that I think are fantastic and will always be Austin, Texas, you know, and it's the people in it. And
it's
some of the landmarks and just the way of life and the mentality. But what has really changed for younger people is the cost of living, the cost of housing. Like, we were in Travis Heights paying $400 for rent, right?
That's $200
each.
And
now there's nowhere in town, dude, where you can...
No, you're right.
You can make a living as an artist.
I bet that scene's going on in
and
Detroit.
And live in a cheap-ass place.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I was young and an artist, I would have been in Detroit 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I would have... Boom, man. Get a badass building. And I think that's a normal progression for everything.
Yeah.
But Austin, man, it's the live capital music city of the world, man. And it's like, you know, and there's so many creative people here. But a lot of my friends, even older people that are somewhat established, can't afford to be here.
Yeah.
So they're going to Elgin.
Yeah.
Wimberley.
Right.
You know, Bastrop.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people you know live in Bastrop or Buda or...
They live in Buda. Your brother
Round
lives
Rock
in Buda.
Or, yeah. Yeah. Because we just can't, you know.
Do you live out there?
I live? Actually live on, I just moved to Stastny and South Congress.
Okay.
I mean, I've been east, but I wanted to buy a house east, and I couldn't afford it.
No.
So I bought a little place, you know, pre-construction. I got a good deal on it. You know, and its proximity to everything's still good.
Yeah.
And then studio's still on the east side in a big warehouse over there, you know.
Right.
But that's in transition too, so... I'm getting ready to move to Canopy, actually.
Where's that?
Where Big Medium is, right there at Springdale and
Palm.
Yeah. There's a really nice space right there that CoLab rented out for a while, and they just vacated it. And I'm thinking of doing studio in the back, small gallery up front, like I did at Flatbed for all those years.
Yeah.
You know, Gallery 68.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm going to call it yet, and I haven't signed the lease, but I'm excited about the possibility of doing programming again.
Yeah.
Contemporary art, performance art, and music.
Yeah.
Whatever I want to do.
Yeah.
You know? And I'll sync it up with Big Medium schedule, which I think they have 7 or 8 openings a year.
Okay.
And then it'll revolve around East Austin and all the other things that they, you know, spearheaded, you know?
How many shows do you do a year? Like, how many art shows are you involved in a year?
Not as many in the last couple years. Well, I say that, and it's like it's a perpetual thing, and it's really random. I was like last year, I'd say I did like 4 shows, but most of them were group shows.
The neon show I saw you at.
Yeah, I did Pop Austin.
Yeah,
I did Pop Austin last year, and then it's Conception the first year.
Okay.
But I just did in that Pop Austin show, I had a little installation room off on the side and then a couple individual pieces.
Uh-huh.
And then this year I just did 1 piece.
Right.
And then there were 2 locations and I had some other works at the track, but it got rained out.
Oh, okay.
Like the weather was horrible out there. So.
Yeah.
And that was cool. Actually, that's the last time I showed. Those are the only 2 things I've done in Austin since the Austin Museum or at Art House.
Okay.
I did a show with Julie Speed, and that was like 8 or 9 years ago.
Wow.
So I've been showing all over the place. But
all over
just
the world.
Didn't
you do something in Germany over the last
year or something? Yeah, I've done stuff and had group shows that traveled all over recently in Turkey and Greece.
Do you go to those and go to the openings?
Not all the time. The Germany shows I did.
Okay.
I was over there at a foundry just making art, and I ended up...
Like in a sabbatical kind of way?
Well, like, not really. Mean? You know, it's hard for me to get away with the kids. You know, I still have, well, I have two sleds, 21 now.
Right.
You know, often it's University of Colorado. He's a junior. And then.
Wow, he's a junior?
Yeah, junior, man. And wow. Calder's 13. So, you know, for me, I'll be in Austin as long as I have, you know, the kids in school here. And
right.
Probably when Calder gets out of high school, then I'll reevaluate. And, you know, I might want to change it up and maybe even go to Europe. Because, man, I love Germany in particular. But I went over there to do a residency originally to do, it was a supposed to be a 3-month residency, and it's in a little town called Helmsen.
Yeah.
And it was two professors two brothers that teach at Texas Tech, and they went over there. And then Gus Capriva, who owns Redbug Gallery in Houston,
okay,
kind of organized this exchange, basically. And so I went over there and was only, because of kids, was only able to commit to 2 weeks of a 3-month residency. But right. I was like, dude, I'll come the tail end, and I'll crank it out, and we'll do a show. So these guys have been there all summer working.
And you went out there.
And got there, yeah. And I had 2 weeks to do my third of this huge exhibit that ended up traveling all over Germany.
Did it have, like, a central focus? Is that why you worked out there?
Well, it was during... The show itself didn't. What it was just Americans coming, you know, it was
okay,
just
okay.
a representation
okay.
of yeah, our yeah. individual works, okay. you know? And I didn't really play off of their work. We did collaborate some together, mm-hmm. all three of us. But I tapped into just the energy, you know. I was going to bring materials and maybe even work on things here and then bring them there because I had such a tight deadline to do this show. And I just kind of abandoned that idea and thought, you know, I just want to show up and respond and react to the environment. And that's what this work was about. And we were in... a former slaughterhouse, like 150-year-old, you know, it used to be a pig slaughterhouse. And it was 125,000 square feet.
Jesus.
And there was all this old post-Cold War, like materials and machinery that this guy who ran this place got for free. They're like, if you pick it up, you can have it. So... all these kilns and all this shit. And he was a glass artist, the guy who kind of ran the place we were working at. But anyway, so I showed up and day one, man, it was just like all summer long. The whole time I was there, I ended up staying on a little longer, but it was gray every day, you know?
Yeah.
And we were about 30 miles from the train station that was next to Auschwitz. And so the climate was thick. Real thick at the time with the Bush administration. And so I basically was, you know, having all this dialogue about politics and my head wanted to explode because I could never really articulate or say
right.
what I wanted when I wanted to say it.
Right.
And so this gave me the opportunity to really think about, it was hard not to be an American in Germany and not think about World War II because you're reminded of it everywhere.
Right.
And that's just for me, that's what I felt, maybe because it was coming from the climate that was going on in America at the time.
Right.
And so when I got there, man, I just immediately channeled this energy that was so, and you know, as an artist, we all know, like, dude, when it's there, you just take it and run with it.
Yeah.
And it literally felt like the sky was coming through my, channeling through my arms, man, you know?
Wow.
And after day one, I had done 11 pieces. Maybe that's a funny number, but it's like,
that's a lot.
I had done these found object assemblage pieces that were just, I basically did the whole show.
Wow.
And then I started just fine-tuned and kept doing things, but it's like this, you know, this magical moment, you know. And so then I went back, I ended up pulling the show off and felt amazing about the pieces I had done.
Right.
And they were more about death, really, than they were about war. They were about human beings and the casualty and the remnants and what happens in war.
Yeah.
And then I went back and did a full-on body of work that I started called Empire that was about...
Yeah.
That was about war, you know?
Yeah.
And I used a lot of metaphors and a lot of, you know, and did, you know, for example, like Heads of States, the stuffed taxidermy snake with
right,
three heads.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bush Cheney runs in the striking position.
Right.
You know, and like, you know, Country Divided, which is all 50 stars from the American flag, jewel cast. And then there's a stick that's shaped kind of like a boomerang or a wedge.
Right.
And it's going through it. And it's an installation piece where, you know, 50 stars and this thing's just plowing through the middle of it.
Right.
And it's Country Divided.
And that's the one with the snakes in the dollar sign.
That's a different one.
Okay.
But this one's just, you know, the stars from the flag and a wedge going through them, separating.
Yeah.
You know,
if you're listening to this and you want to see this, you can go to Bale's website, BaleCreekAllen.com. And there's actually, there's an Empire section. We can go there and look at all the pieces.
Yeah. And that was all just real raw bronze, you know?
Yeah.
And I had never casted on my own. I'd utilized foundries and kind of executed things, you know, more like a director would, you know, which is typical with most bronze casting, you know, you working in collaboration with the foundry. But
right.
I went over there and made my own molds and did my own pours. And that whole Empire, all that bronze was from Henry Moore's source. So it was like this, arguably the purest
bronze
recipe of bronze.
Right.
And so I had these bullion cubes that looked like gold, and that's kind of the natural color. But when I melted them, I didn't do it right. Like, I poured them on a cold surface and they reacted and bubbled and shit.
Right.
And so I spent, like a week and a half making molds, like literally day and night making these beautiful, intricate molds. And then when I did the pour, you know, none of them turned out. And so I was devastated because I was like, man, I've been here the whole time and all this shit's been wasted.
Right.
And then sure enough, man, I was just out of desperation. I'm just like, man, let me just look at these. And I washed one off and looked at it. And I thought, I got chills, man. I was like, wait a minute. These are freaking gorgeous. I mean, just stunning.
Because then with all of that
burnt,
stuff.
They were covered with burnt. Yeah, they had holes in them.
Yeah,
and it was all about war.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, then I just couldn't, you know, take the molds, you know, the plaster off these things fast enough. And I was just like, man. So I went back three different times and cast in that style.
And so then each one is unique. Even if you're using the same molds, they're still unique because of the things that are happening. Yeah.
No pun intended, but that's why they catch on fire and everything. But they're from not a production mold, but they're like a dissolvable, you know, lost wax process where you take an organic object and dip it in wax and firm it up. Then you build like a real soft plaster mold around it and it hardens. And then you once you have the mold, when you fire the mold, the organic material disintegrates. So you're left with, you know, a mold of whatever object was in there.
Yeah.
And then you pour molten bronze in there and then dissolve the mold around that. So it's kind of like you just take turns with the process till you have the bronze, you know, object.
Right.
Which is a replica, but it's like a total mutated, you know.
And
certain
There's
things
something
I want
brutal
perfectly
about those pieces.
Polished,
yeah.
You know. But this was just worked great, you know.
Yeah.
So through that process, I embraced it, and, you know, now it's like my favorite way to do bronze. You know?
Yeah. Do you have any shows coming up?
Anything? I've got two shows up right now that are in Upper State New York. One outside of Syracuse. Let's see. One's at Skidmore College.
Uh-huh.
And it's a group show at the Tang Museum there with some really great artists. And they're going to do a beautiful published book, which I'm looking forward to.
Nice.
And then the other show is the Rockwell Museum. Just it's an acquisition. They just bought one of the last cast bronze tumbleweeds.
Fantastic.
And then upcoming, I don't have anything really scheduled right now, and I've done that deliberately. And what happened last year was I was so frustrated with dealing with galleries that and really wanting to work in a certain way, larger scale. And so I decided I was going to get rid of I had five galleries in 2014. The beginning of 2015, I got rid of four of them. And I just said, you know, I didn't burn any bridges or anything. I just said, send my work back, you know.
Right.
This isn't, you know, wasn't really, didn't represent me. These galleries didn't particularly represent what my, you know,
we weren't
really
that.
In alignment.
Right.
And I'm still with Gerald Peters, which I have kind of a sense of loyalty to, because it's, you know, I was with Pillsbury and Peters originally in Dallas, which doesn't exist now. But Ted Pillsbury, who's no longer with us, he came to my studio, bought some work, gave me a show. And then I had so much success there that it afforded me to quit waiting tables, you know.
Yeah.
I've never had a real job since then,
yeah.
You know. So I've shown with them in New York and in Santa Fe, but mostly in Santa Fe now. And some of my work fits into kind of what they're,
yeah.
you know, what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
But not most of it. So we work with the things that do. But outside of that, what I thought I would do is just sit down with patrons of mine and collectors and try to raise money on my own. And I sat down with the first two people I sat down with, own my work. They've supported contemporary art, you know, on a large scale, very wealthy, can afford it. But they, you know, they both passed. The third person I asked, I was like, look, this is my vision. This is what I want to do. And I need help to get this thing off the ground. You know, are you interested in being a part of this? And so, yes, that sounds fascinating. I want to help you make this happen. So then I raised the money to do all the groundwork and get all the tools needed. And now I'm continuing to raise money, but the body of work's called My America, and it's a survey of the entire country. And I'm starting with the state of Texas and kind of doing it as like a kind of like a template, maybe. You know, I think I'll learn a lot in doing one state extensively, and then I could assess at the end of the year, which I plan on completing this by the end of the year, the Texas version. And then I'll know what all my expenses are. I'm going to 16 cities
okay.
in Texas.
Okay.
And I'm basically taking a truck with a camper shell, with a trailer, and a motorcycle. And there's all these projects that I have that are, it's pretty conceptual, but there's also a lot of it's very, half of it's more conceptual than the other half's very attainable, you know, works of art that I'm going to be pulling from these ideas, you know.
Right.
So there'll be physical museum type show. And the idea is not to show in galleries, but I have raised the money on the front end. So there's no outside influence whatsoever on the type of work I'm doing or what type of work I'm doing, which for me never really has played anyway.
Okay, because I was going to, do galleries have some kind of say in what the artists are?
Well, they
can
have,
you give me something a little more?
You know,
do they really?
Put it this way, you know, most of my galleries would love it if I was the tumbleweed guy, or if I did, you know, because they can make a shitload of money,
and I can make
a shitload of money.
Yeah.
And those things are great to have as an artist, but man, that's not what I do. It's like some of those things stick and some of them don't. And the ones that do, it's great to have that in your back pocket. And as long as you're interested in doing something like that or a commission or whatever, it's fantastic when people respond to your work and want to own it, you know, no doubt trying to make a living.
Yeah.
But man, that is not what drives what I do in any way, shape, or form. I mean, what drives me is the quality of the work.
Yeah.
Just the work itself, first and foremost, period. Like, if that gets compromised, then I'd rather paint houses or go back to waiting tables and continue making art.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I'm almost to that point. It feels like, you know, because it's like a roller coaster, but, you know, it's...
yeah.
It's a tough way to make a living, you know, but I thought, I've always in the back of my head had these huge, bigger ideas and always been discouraged from doing most of them because they're incredibly, impractical. I mean, if you're doing an installation that's the size of a, you know, that's 2,000 square foot room, for example, and you have one piece in it,
right?
That's like a sound piece that you know no one's really going to acquire,
right?
Unless it's a museum acquisition or right. a permanent installation, and
right.
But you're doing this out of pocket,
right?
You know, you're basically, and I've done a lot of installation art that, man, ends up, you know, going in storage or given away or dismembered and then gone, you know, and you document it or you don't. And
wow.
It's
yeah
of the moment, and it's for the sake of the work, you know, but it gets very expensive too.
Yeah.
To try to do that. And so I had this idea of doing something of that magnitude, which this body of work, My America, it's a pretty ambitious body of work. Because
if you're doing one state in a year, then how well, long is it going to take you to do the rest of the
what, yeah, no, what I'm doing is,
okay,
the projected thing is a five-year
okay.
deal. And what, I mean, I literally could do a version of this My America in a year if I streamlined it that way. But what I want to do first, since it's a trial type of thing, is focus on what I know best, what's accessible, what's right here.
Yeah.
And I want to do a body of work that, whether it's part of My America or whether that it's its own cohesive, really solid body of work.
Right.
And I want to put everything into it, you know, and apply these ideas and concepts. And some of the ideas are like, for example, I'm going to go to an abandoned house or a historical building that has been left to rot, that has some kind of history behind it, whether it's the town, whether it's the building itself, what I can muster up and use that as motive, kind of as direction, you know, mm-hmm. For the subject matter. And I want to go in and document it with photograph, mm-hmm. a before photograph, and then completely rearrange the interior of this just decrepit whatever, utilizing what's there.
Okay.
And create these beautiful installations of just found object stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. And then document the after. And then what I want to do is do a before and after photograph and pull one of the found object pieces and display it in the middle. So ideally, the big scheme of things is I want to have 50 versions of this.
Okay.
One for every state. And then I want to do a map of My America. And my map is where you could actually, as a viewer, go on your own tour of My America. Because
okay.
someone might discover this or never discover it again.
Yeah.
And that's...
This is really ambitious, you know. But it's awesome.
Yeah. So, you know, and the other one, I want to take highway lines
yeah.
with the diamond saw, cut them out of every major interstate in the United States. And I want to fill the voids with things that pertain to that state or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Fill the voids
and
basically do a treasure map using mile markers. You
yeah.
know, and then with the highway lines that, you know, are excavated,
yeah.
I want to build like this totemistic United States sculpture of 50 highway lines stacked together.
Ah, that's awesome.
And that's another idea.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, but it's just on and on and on. It's kind of infinite. And I want to document the parallels, you know, well, not really the parallels, but the extreme differences and the things that, you know, the commonalities in every state.
Right.
And so like strip centers.
Yeah.
That basically we all know, you look at a Target and a PetSmart and everything.
Yeah.
And they're everywhere in America.
Yeah.
And you
it's
would
like
never
a little
know.
Thing they place.
Yeah.
Just
50 photographs. Everyone
yeah,
looks fucking sick.
Yeah. You wouldn't know where
period.
You are. Yeah.
And so I want to do things that unify like that. And then I want to do things that show the real uniqueness in every state. You know,
yeah.
and what makes them individual. And this was spawned on by the idea of, you know, as an artist, it's a kind of a metaphor for how I live my life, you know, and basically through this, I consider myself somewhat well-traveled
mm-hmm.
and I've never been to every state in
right.
my own country.
Right.
And I've talked to a lot of people. Most, there's very few people I've ever talked to that
They've
have
been to all of them. Yeah.
And they're more well traveled than I am.
Yeah.
And so the idea of being able to do this as my own curiosity as a person,
yeah,
and my own desire to go and actually physically experience that, you know, and take a trip like that.
Yeah.
But to turn that into work as well.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that's...
But to me, that's who you are. Like, that's... You know what I mean? You are, as all artists should be,
so. You
are part of the art.
Yeah. Well, you know,
and what you're going through is part of the art, and what you're, you know, you are.
That's interesting. And I think about that a lot because yes and no, you know, it's like I've had this discussion with people before just about like how do you decide what's good art or what's, you know.
It's what speaks to you, really. I mean, that's the thing that's been, I mean, especially in what you do, there's, I mean, in music too, but there is kind of like, well, I mean, you know, I guess there's stuff that I really like that I think some people would not even find to be music. You know what I'm saying? Same with you, probably.
Yeah.
Did you, were a punk kid, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Fresno and,
What was going on
in Fresno?
I
graduated in 1987.
Right, me too.
So.
We're the same age.
Yeah. Damn right.
Yeah, both born 68.
Yeah.
87, guys.
Cheers to that, man.
So your dad is Terry Allen, for those that, I mean, I'm sure I said it in the intro. Your mom is Joe Harvey Allen.
Yeah.
And your brother is Bucca Allen.
Yeah.
So you're older than Bucca, right?
No, he's older.
No,
Buck's older.
Okay. Yeah. How much? 2 years?
Punk. Yeah. 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Year and a half.
So were you,
exactly.
you were born in California?
Or? I was born in California. Mom and dad are both from Lubbock. And literally, I think when they were seniors in high school, they flipped a coin. They were like, we're going to New York or LA. And they were both just ready to get the hell out of West Texas.
Right.
Landed on Tails and Tails, I guess, or whatever was, you know, California. So
right. They
went out there and dad went to Chouinard, which is now CalArts.
Okay.
But it was downtown LA and Walt Disney did all the animation there and everything. And a lot of great artists came out of that. And this was early 60s. Then ended up right after that teaching at Watts for 1 year, mm-hmm. and avoided the draft from Vietnam then. And then got offered a teaching gig at Cal Berkeley. So right after Berkeley, I think he was there like a couple years. And I was 3 years old when we moved to Fresno.
Okay.
And then I spent... Mom and dad stayed there until I got out of high school, you know, and literally the day I graduated, the house was for sale.
Where did they move? Where did they, like, oh, they live in New Mexico?
And then they moved to Santa Fe.
Yeah.
And they've been the same place since then, you know. But yeah, Buck and I grew up, man, in Fresno. And I mean, our school was Fast Times at Ridgemont High. There's no, that's, it's like.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, like, yeah.
That
yeah.
was. I rode my skateboard, you know,
yeah.
from class to class.
Yeah,
you know, dropping in off the roof, literally shit like that. I had a mohawk, you know,
yeah,
leopard skin dudes,
and
wore half my mom's clothes with motorcycle boots. You know, I mean, it's like we're just like, and went to the most amazing music concerts because then it's like, well, the punk bands would tour. Half of California. If they were ambitious, they'd go to California. They would go from LA to Sacramento and back.
Right.
Fresno was right in the middle.
Right.
Fresno, every freaking band in California that toured
yeah.
was going to go to Fresno.
So who all did you get to see?
Oh, man. Like
Circle Jerks.
Suicidal Tendencies.
And, yeah.
Dead Kennedys.
Yeah.
Agent Orange.
Yeah.
Jody Foster's Army. Circle Jerks.
Yeah.
Saw Fair. Saw X 20 times.
Wow.
You know, I mean, every... Who didn't I get to see?
That's amazing.
I mean, it's, yeah, you know, and then, you know, then the touring, like, you know, I just found an old flyer from a show that was The Fix, Thompson Twins, and The Police.
Shit.
And I was like in ninth grade, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I was
yeah.
thinking, you know, the shows then, there were like five, you know, three to five to eight bands.
Right.
Like they'd come and play in a stadium and
right.
it would be all day. And it wasn't really a festival. It was just like, yeah, we have 10 people on the bill.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, for one ticket price, you'd just sit there all day and see shitloads of bands.
Yeah.
And that was pretty great.
When you go see music now, what do you go see?
Oh,
this
man.
Season
you know what? I
outside of your friends. Because I find that that's the $1 million question. You're just like, you're like, you know what? Well, occasionally I'll go see a touring band, but mostly I just go see my friends.
Now what I do is I more or less just, I go and see mostly my friends.
Yeah.
That's kind of.
Right, yeah.
You know, and more, I look in the paper, I don't know any of the bands.
Yeah.
Or not as much. I mean, no. I'll admit that. It's just like, you know, when we lived here, there you could look through the paper, and I think it's being young and being out every night.
Yeah.
You know, and now, you know, you have kids, you have, you know.
You've been out.
50.
You're pushing 50. You've been out. You spent 25 years going out.
Yeah.
And you get to a point where you're like, okay.
You become a little more selective, I think, you know. But, like, for example, I went to the Saxon the other night and watched David Grissom and his band play. And just had the greatest time ever, man. Just sat there just tripping out. And prior to that, I think, you know, I go up to the upstairs of the Continental. It's probably my favorite place to sit out.
That's me too, yeah.
And see music, you know, on any given night, you know. I think it's environments too that I gravitate to. And I'm real simple that way. It's just like, where do I want to be comfortable?
It's that place is curated by our friends. That we kind of came up with.
Yeah.
So it's familiar, whatever they're putting in there, you know, we'll probably like.
Probably a safe bet. Yeah. And still is, I think. And when I bring younger people there or people from out of town, you know, their mouths are on the ground. That's like blown away by it. So
At least
we have good taste.
Yeah. Well, people like you and me probably get like emails or text messages or calls from people like, hey, I'm coming to town. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to be out of town playing. Well, where should I go? And I'm just always like, oh, Continental Club.
Exactly.
Either the downstairs or just go to the, you know, go to the gallery first. That, you know, you don't have to usually pay cover. The cover's pretty low. That's an issue. You know, you'll go in there. You'll have your mind blown. Go downstairs
Same
and do the thing.
Same exact thing.
Yeah. And the thing is, they're always like, who's playing? And I'm like, I don't know. But it's going to be awesome.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's going to be fine. You're going to have a great time.
Yeah.
I promise. Yeah. So, okay. So let's go back to Fresno. So. Were you playing then? Did you have a dream? Because you grew up in with these artists and probably around all of these other artists and subversive people. Like, what was your rebellion? Were you like a Republican or something?
You know what my rebellion was, ironically, was that I didn't drink. I didn't do drugs.
Oh, that's good.
And most of my friends did.
Yeah.
And that culture did.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like, it became kind of just my identity in a way. It's like, and I always say I was born high on life. I have more energy than any freaking,
I will say that,
you know,
to
I mean,
be
I
true.
Always have, yeah, have you a always lot have. Of energy. Yeah. And it's like, you know, from getting busted from kindergarten on, man, you know, it's like, if there was an ADD kid, it was me. I think they called them hyper pills and they wanted me on them quick, you know, but of course, no. Are you kidding me?
I mean, luckily you were born to the right parents.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Because under the other circumstances, they wouldn't have been like, oh, look at this ultra creative, imaginative kid we have. They'd be like, the fuck is wrong with this kid?
Yeah, exactly, you know? Man.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I realized also early on how unique my family was from just the way our house looked on the inside.
Yeah.
You know, it was plastered with art. And then by the type of people that would come and visit. And it was just like, you know, so interesting and so different the way they talk, you know, the way people dressed and talked and communicated than all my other friends' parents and all my other friends, you know, for the most part in Fresno. And so, I mean, to answer your question, just like what, you know, when I was a kid, I always thought I would either be and it's not a stretch growing up in the environment I grew up, but either an actor, a musician, an artist, or an athlete. And that's like, those are kind of the things that a lot of kids would, you know, it's not that unique, but those were all, that was it. It's like, I didn't aspire to be a businessman. No. I thought about doing amazing creative things.
Yeah.
You know, or like, the things that I loved.
Yeah.
And I think I had a great support system and a family that nurtured my individuality and that supported me no matter what and I also, was doing.
Right. You know? And it was a real, it's a real trade. It's a real living. You grew up where that was a real,
you saw that as a reality.
It wasn't like a dream, like, wait, you mean I can paint things and I can, you know.
Yeah, you did give me the tools, you know, to, and the confidence to be like, I want to go to art school.
Yeah.
So the parents, like, hell, you're going to art school, you know. Yeah.
So were you in theater and stuff in high school or no?
I did a little theater. I did a couple of the plays, nothing major, but we did some performance art as a family. And I always like that word more than acting or theater because it gives you certain liberties to more, you know, creative and unique, you know, and it's performance and you're acting, but it's like, well, who says I need to memorize my lines? Why not just read them off of this big projector, like, you know, animated way, or whatever, you know? So, you know, and part of the environment and the sets and everything is as much about what I'm doing as, you know, so it was all just every medium to me. It's like, I always describe like what I do and what I draw from is the world is my playground.
Yeah.
And I take whatever I'm thinking about, whatever I want to apply, you know, to the necessity of what that art needs, you know, is where I go. You know, whether it's video or whether it's theater or writing, like, they're all very different ways of doing something creatively or having a voice.
Yeah.
And I always gravitated, I think, to visual art. Originally, I think my mom's an actress and that kind of wore off on me too. And so I thought I would give that a try and move to LA right after high school.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, I was spending all my time going on auditions and trying to learn lines or doing certain things and realized that the actual amount of time I was spending working or, you know, working on that craft, that acting, was basically none.
Right.
I was a busboy at a restaurant and working my ass off and trying to get roles and I was sitting there going, man, you know, and the one thing I did consistently every day was draw.
Yeah.
At night I was just like, fuck, drawing pictures and whatever, or work on a screenplay, you know, or have ideas.
Yeah.
And it's those things that I could do on my own. And so I gravitated to visual art because the immediacy of it.
Yeah.
You know, the immediacy is I can go any time of the day, anytime I want, in my studio and do what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I love collaborating with people, but I'm the type of person where I think I'm too impatient. Maybe I'm too particular as well. Like on day in and day out, you know, I want to be in control of that creative process and have that access to it.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
I want immediate access.
I know exactly. That's why I have this. Because like, I don't want to wait on somebody to do something.
Exactly.
I don't want to wait on a bass player to come over. I'm going to fucking do it myself.
And thank God musicians are able to record now without having to.
Right.
Or, you know, since that, I mean, you know, that whole world's changed radically since we met.
Yeah. Jesus. Yeah.
That idea of getting a record deal, no one knows what that is anymore.
No.
Or I don't.
People are still doing it, but it's weird.
It's like,
it's real weird.
Or a record or an album.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, shit, dude, we'd lay there and listen to records that were like, listen to someone. I was talking to Allison about, this is my fiance.
Yes. Oh, congratulations, by the way.
And I was talking to her about the river, you know, how when I was a kid, I laid there like, I don't know how many days I laid on the couch after school, put the river on, closed my eyes and went for a journey.
Yeah.
And there were records like that, that literally, you know, you just totally get lost in them. You know?
It's weird because I talk about this shit all the time on here with people, and it's the society has moved into this like faster kind of like boom 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 boom, you know what I mean?
Like immediacy
more than even ADD, like kind of like you're always on this like multitasking thing and stuff. And I even see it like in rehearsals. Like I don't really get on my Like, if there's a break, yeah, I'll check and see. Sometimes I'm waiting on emails or something. But, like, it's real weird to be at a rehearsal and everyone's just sitting there looking at their phone.
It's about what's next or where you're going.
And no one's
being
in the moment.
Completely present.
Yes.
You know?
I have this thing at shows.
All the beauties right there. It's right in front of you, man.
Yeah.
To be present, to be fully present and aware and take in your environment. It's like Allison was just at the new Whitney, like a few months back, like right after it had opened. And she sent me a photograph that she just couldn't help but take. But there were about 15 people sitting down on the benches, all on phones at the new in the museum.
Yeah.
And it was just like, that's kind of what's happening, man. And people. I think you look at pop culture and you look at reality TV and all this bullshit, which is what it is. And these kids aspire through this social media or whatever it is. They aspire to be famous.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's not about, they don't aspire to be great at something. And then
I mean, you
be
tell
recognized
me what
for
a
it.
Kardashian actually fucking does. Other than be a complete...
They screw sports stars and rock stars and they get fucked up at places and they get paid a fucking $500,000 to go hang out at a club opening for 3 hours.
To hang out
for real.
And do
that's what
nothing
they do. That's what,
but
that's,
be little shits, you know? And it's like... It's, and kids see this and they want what they have, which is some kind of celebrity status.
But isn't it weird? Because I think that when I wanted to be good at something, I did want to be recognized. I wanted to be famous for, but I did want to be real good at what I did. I wanted to be able to play a song.
Well, people were usually famous for doing something.
Yeah, exactly.
Now they're famous for doing nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Nothing at all.
Yeah.
Other than being motivated by that. So they're looking, you know, they're looking to go through the whole alphabet without experiencing it.
Right.
You know, I'm going to leapfrog from fucking A to Z and I want to get there as fast as I can get there.
Right.
Instead of thinking, man, you don't need any of that shit. Actually, A, B, and C could be the baddest ass journey.
Right.
Of your life.
Oh, yeah.
But you're not even going to experience the journey.
Well, I think that culture has created a person who can actually run for president that is so absurd as a human being.
You're right.
With so little compassion for other human beings, which to me, like, that's like the thing that you think about when you think about those guys, that they had a heart and thought about other people, not called people names. And there's literally a guy that's like winning the whole thing right now.
That's
just an asshole.
It's mind-boggling.
It's like literally an asshole.
Yeah. I mean, call it like it is. Whether you're a Republican, whether you're independent Democrat.
Even if you
call
like
it
him,
it is.
He's an asshole.
Asshole is an asshole. Yeah, I agree with you, man.
Yeah.
And when someone is that, you know, acts that way towards their fellow human, you know, on such a consistent basis. But, you know, this is why someone like Trump can actually be where he's at. It's alarming, disturbing, upsetting, but that's representative of
our
America
culture.
Right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, that's our culture.
And you know what? Artists are going to be more neat. We're going to hit this thing again. This is going to be like fucking the Lenny Bruces of the day. There's going to have to be artists that are really going to have to become movements again to shake things up, because it's gotten so. It's got, you know, the 70% now of America that would subscribe to something like that or rally behind that or even, you know, it's that 30% or whatever. I'm just throwing it out. I don't know the numbers, man. But the creative people need to have more of a voice. And it's going to become more radical because this...
It has to.
It has to.
Yeah.
So
and
now's
I mean,
the time to you know, speak up about shit like that and do work about that and, you know, about the things that really matter to you and going through that journey instead of being one of these dipshits that rallies behind a moron.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. Hey, you know, my mind went off on this thing, and it made me think about your work always has, like, a great big view. And I wonder if that comes from so much of creative people are, like, going to creativity running from something, but you didn't have to. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, they're getting away from something, and it's their only way to freedom. It's their only way out of this, whatever it is they're in.
Yeah.
Like, this small town, this shitty life, this horrible home that I'm raising. But you're raising this home where people allow you to be creative. And so there isn't a lot of me in your work. There's a lot of, like, look around and see this thing, which I appreciate and I think is amazing. It's not...
That's an very interesting observation, because I think my situation as an artist, or the way I was raised in a family of artists, contributed to that, and also makes it very unique to where I had that support, you know, total support system.
Yeah.
And I was exposed to creativity my whole life.
Yeah.
And I was never pressured or forced to do anything. I mean, I could have, you know, been a tax man and, you know, it's unconditional love.
Cool.
It's just great parents.
Yeah, yeah.
But that happened to be very creative, and my whole family.
Yeah.
And so from that perspective, it's not like a lot of people are suppressed and have shitty experiences growing up and art is their escape, you know. But for me, I think it's more of a curiosity. I think it's more of like, and a challenge.
Right.
You know, and, but it's something that also, you know, you hear artists say this, and it's true. It's something I have to do.
Yeah.
It's something that no matter what, my whole life, I'll have to create things.
Right.
And that doesn't mean I'll have to make a living as an artist my whole life. You know, get a job if I need money. But
you're going to have to make art.
And no matter what I'm doing for work, I'm still going to have to create, and I will. Because it's just something that, you know, that I've been encouraged to do and that I've been exposed to.
Right.
And so I do understand that about artists, that suffering artists and that, you know, misery, you know, can breed amazing work. But
right.
I also had a great example of parents that made great art at a very high level that were also incredible parents.
Yeah.
And cared about being good people and lived a somewhat freaking normal life.
Right.
Probably more normal than most of what is you view as normal.
Yeah.
You know, on the outside, you know, people thought I was a drug addict and bad news because I had eyeliner and a fucking mohawk. But man, I wasn't the problem.
No.
You know, maybe I was. But you know, so that was... I've always had a really good example, and I come from a really close family.
Yeah,
so
you do.
When you have a parental influence and you have two.
Yeah.
And even a brother that you love and respect.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I love that.
Then, man, it makes your life easier.
Yeah.
And there's one thing I am, and that's blessed, to have been born into that family.
Yeah.
And I struggle with that for a moment in art school. Because when I went to art school was late 80s. And like, I think that second month I was there, my dad was on the cover of Art News, you know. And my friends were like, what the fuck, dude? You're Terry Allen's son? What are you doing here? Why are you even here? And so I was young and whatever and fiery and ambitious and ready to conquer the world, you know. And everything I did was great, you know. I was like, but it was like, you know, that's what your brain's just swelling that way, especially when you're in that environment. And so I had a moment there to where I was like, man, I just want to distance myself and kind of carve my own. It's like, you know, and a light went off, you know, and I was just like, man, that is absurd. I don't give a shit. Never have what other people think or say. And for me, it's an incredible advantage coming from a family like I come from. And, you know, I know as a dad that I want to do the same for my kids. I want to do anything and everything I can to make their lives easier or better.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I get it.
I met them that day, the day that I met you. Your parents came that day to that party.
Damn, that's right.
Yeah. They were so cool. And I just seen, like...
I remember that day,
I had
man.
Just
what
seen,
a trip.
Like, maybe a month or two before a piece that your dad had of, like, this fucking dripping Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
in like, Art News or Art in America or something for some... It was an ad, and I was just, like, I was obsessed with it. I cut it out, and I put it on my wall. And when... I remember at one point going, like, Terry Allen. And then I was like, is that guy, like,
wild,
the
man.
Artist, Terry? I'm like, yeah. I was like, oh, my God. This is, like, the coolest party I've ever been to in my life. So, yeah, it's amazing. And I remember seeing a show that he had some pieces at the at Flatbed. It was, over a decade
ago.
Yeah,
I had a gallery there.
You had a gallery there.
And my dad did a solo show there of study drawing. Study watercolors and paint, you know, draw, like, you know.
I think that's what I want to.
Studies for sculptures. Yeah. I had the gallery for 10 years at Flatbed. And it was called Gallery 68. And that was another point in my life where I was kind of frustrated at the gallery situation. So I just opened my own. And I did my own shows.
Did you enjoy that?
It's fantastic.
Because I liked going to those shows.
I loved it. I loved it. And had real low overhead. It was a tiny space. But, man, I mean, with the 300-square-foot space, you could freaking... you know, load a good a punch as any gallery in the world if you do it right. If you do it the way you want to do it, you know?
here was a question I wanted to ask when you were talking about your dad. When you're doing this, the next project that you're working on about America, like, do you run stuff like that by him? Like, when you have the idea, do you go like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this?
Yeah, we talk about things. Yeah, we do. We talk about them. And my dad's funny. It's like, if he doesn't like something, he just won't say anything.
Okay.
So that's how you know.
Right.
Right. Like, moving on or what are you talking
about? Yeah.
I've noticed how he views things, you know, and of course he'd probably, who knows what he would say about me saying that. But,
right.
But, you know, very profound and selective when my dad opens his mouth, usually there's something good comes out.
Yeah.
Something
I can
like
imagine.
Intelligent.
Yeah.
And opinionated. So, but it's like, so we do bounce things off, and we've collaborated together on music, and we've tried to collaborate together on sculptures, and I hope that we will soon. We almost did a piece at Rice University and worked on all this stuff, and it kind of fell through, you know, on the other end. So, it'd be great to work together. But it's funny because I've actually, you know, I'm kind of critical myself, you know, about viewing work and very, very opinionated and have my own idea about it, as I should. But, you know, I have ended up several times in the back of my head. I do this in my songs sometimes, and I do this in my art. And I've done things that my dad's done. And it's like, I mean, I can't think offhand, but sometimes I'll do like an image or have an idea of a piece and think it's my own. And it's something I saw like in 1977 that my dad did. And it's the weirdest thing.
It's pretty cool though.
So it is cool. It's amazing. But it's also when you're trying to just kind of do your own thing, not just with your dad, but that's the most natural thing when you're literally 50% of someone and you're exposed to them and what they do constantly, it's impossible for some of that not to seep onto you.
Yeah.
And that's where I had an issue with that momentarily, but then I embraced that and I'm also just amazed by it. And I've done that with other artists, which is great. It's the greatest form of flattery or what's the term? I don't know. When you actually replicate someone and don't realize it.
Yeah.
You're thumbing through a book and you see some dude in the 1940s, you know, doing some Dada shit, and you're like, fuck, I just did that in my studio. I mean, chicken bones lined up the same way, hanging on the... You're like, holy shit, you know?
Yeah.
That's like in Moreau's studio. Yeah. You're like, you know.
You know what's funny is...
But it happens.
When it dawns on me is I'll be doing a song, and I'll finish it, and I'll be like mixing it, and then I'll step away for an hour, and then come back and listen to it, and go like, dude, that's a Wings song.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh my
exactly.
God.
That's like that harmony is the
dumbest
the
thing
Beatles.
I've ever done. Fuck. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it happens to all of us.
Sure, sure.
But it's weird when it happens to your own
your dad.
Dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like...
Yeah. What are they doing now?
Like, they,
I saw them at the Pop Austin thing.
Yeah, they were. They just happened to be in, they didn't even know what was going on. And 2 days prior, they were coming to town. I said, I have an opening that night. Come by.
That's awesome.
So it worked out good.
Yeah.
We're getting ready to do a show of Lubbock on Everything, which is a record my dad did 1976 in Lubbock. That's a double album and concept record. It's all songs about Lubbock. And
what is it about
arguably
that place,
is
man.
Probably his greatest record. You know, I mean, I love them all. I'm a huge fan, but man, it's
called Lubbock on Everything.
Lubbock on Everything. And so we're, you know, all the surviving members, it's a 40 year anniversary this year. We're going to go up Texas Tech. I think it's called the Allen Theater. And this is February 18th. And we're going to go a few days early, rehearse it and perform the entire album live in its entirety. From beginning to end. And it's all the surviving members.
So who is that?
It's all of the Maines brothers.
Okay.
It's Richard Bowden.
Yeah.
My dad. There's the Monterey High School Marching Band. So they're going to use not the original, but they're going to use the current.
Yeah.
You know, people that played on it, Bobby Keys played sax on it,
oh.
You know, Jesse Guitar Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
Were
you around those guys a lot when you were growing up, like Joey Lee and Jesse?
Jesse, for sure, yeah. You know.
And what a special
Bobby
guy.
Bobby Keys I knew, but not well. But yeah. Jesse I knew dearly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like,
awesome,
man,
awesome
I mean, a
guy.
Lot of those people, I just did a residency for 4 months at Texas, in Lubbock, at Texas
okay.
Tech.
Yeah.
And at the Underwood Center, it's called CASP, a Charles Adams Studio Project. And
okay.
They brought me there, paid me, gave me a great studio, and gave me access to all their facilities there. And I just, you know, all summer long, I was in Lubbock making art. I came back and forth 13 times.
Yeah.
To, you know, be with my kids,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And, but man, Lubbock, dude, there is something. Number one, the air there, if you're an artist, the color of the light there, it really is. I mean, it's like, it's kind of like desert light. I don't know what it is.
But there's like this weird thing that happened there, and all these guys came
out
of it. There still
is.
They're all these,
there still is.
There's still these guys.
I've been exposed to the art side of that, and man, they're the undergrad and grads, the art students at Texas Tech.
Right now? Unbelievable.
Freaking good.
Huh.
Pretty damn good, man. And you get the sense that every one of them, once they get out of school, they're going to get the fuck out of there and shotgun spray and go to where the epicenters of creativity are. And but they've honed it in that place where it's void of anything creative. And places like Lubbock, I think that's what happens. And Fresno was the same way. Fresno is, like I say, the only culture in a place like Lubbock, and Fresno is agriculture. it's like, that's it, dude. That's the only culture you get, agriculture, you know? So there's nothing to do, man. So what do? You figure out shit to do. And if that dipshit stuff, like, you know, going out and, you know, doing donuts or, you know, sneaking out at night or whatever. That's one thing. But then there's more, man. There's like...
Yeah, there's something that doesn't... When those guys all shotgun out and leave, that place stays with them.
Yeah.
In some weird way.
Absolutely. And
it
you know
comes
what?
Out
that's,
in weird ways, like that chippy
That's that wholesomeness
record.
Of being raised where everyone's friendly, the disposition of people, even if you don't agree with them politically or
But they're also subversive... I mean, they were like subversive people in a really redneck
yeah.
place. They were like these weird hippies.
Absolutely. That's true. It is a weird...
It's just...
You can't totally put your finger on Lubbock, man. There's
no,
something
man.
In the water is
yeah.
what they say. And if you've ever tasted Lubbock water, you know there's something really shitty. And that's why everyone's teeth are yellow and rotten from Lubbock.
Yeah, It's not the.
If you haven't noticed,
amphetamines.
No offense, guys, but
it's not their meth.
Yeah, no.
it's weird. Hey, this book of yours that I have, I was looking through it, and then I read the beautiful introduction that David Byrne wrote.
Yeah, man, I'm super proud. You know what? MLK Day.
Today is MLK
Day. On this day.
Oh, wow.
However many years ago.
In like 2007 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow, that's weird. That is weird.
Cool.
That didn't even register with me today. So, I mean, he's got a lot to say about your work. How do you know him?
Oh, man. You know what?
How's that? Through your dad?
Well, yeah, through my mom, actually.
Oh, yeah. Because she's in True Stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then, you know, David and my dad had been fans, you know. Obviously, they knew of each other's work, and really, now they're like best friends, which makes sense on a lot of levels. But how we met David was, my mom was doing a one-woman show. I'm not sure which one it was, but she was doing a play, and David went and saw it. And when she got, you know, off stage, she's like, I'm working on a movie. I would love for you to be one of the characters and write your own part, you know, be the lying woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my mom did not know who David was. She didn't know that, you know,
right.
She didn't know who David Byrne was.
Didn't you shit your pants? We were like
so,
in high school.
Yeah,
or
we go back. We're in high school, and this is like in 84 or something like that. And so Baca is the biggest Talking Heads fan there was.
Right.
And he has, you know, Talking Heads 77 and, so, you know, all these great posters in his bedroom.
Yeah.
So my mom comes home, says, yeah, a guy named David Byrne asked me to be in his movie. And my brother just shit a brick, you know. And then my dad's like, yeah, David Byrne of the Talking Heads. And she's like, I think so, yeah. You know, so then it turns out that David and my dad, you know, my dad ended up doing one of the songs on the soundtrack. And I was doing a little acting, and I ended up being the farter, which was like, if you blink, you miss the scene. But the character's the boy in the field, and I'm walking with this girl, and it's a voiceover. But
right.
I said, oh, my stomach feels all fluttery, and I'm with this girl. And she's
and
like,
you fart?
Oh, yeah, me too. And she's like, ooh, did you fart? And then it just fades out to a sunset scene, you know? And so every audition I went after that, I was like, oh, so I hear you were the farter in David Byrne's film. I'm like, that's me. No wonder I didn't get any jobs, man. I'm like, yeah, that's me, man. But since then, you know, my dad and David had become pretty much best friends. And just the whole family. As you know, we're all very, very close. Malou and Adele Lutz, you know, they're not married anymore, but Adele's Malou's mom. And she designed all the costumes and the big suits and everything. And she's an incredible artist.
Yeah.
In fact, I had her do an installation called Medusa Baby at Gallery 68.
Oh, really?
That was amazing. It's like a miniature house, like a border house,
you know,
beautiful little piece. But and Malou and I just collaborated at Gerald Peters in Santa Fe. She's making glass art and just exquisite, you know. She's like a perfect mixture of mom and dad, incredibly smart, incredibly talented, very creative. And she is doing a lot of jewelry now, but she's done these beautiful little prints. It's like everything she touched, you know?
Yeah, yeah. He seems intimidatingly smart.
He
you know what I mean?
He is like, we were just having a conversation. Someone brought him up about just how prolific and how many things he does.
Yeah.
Like from books to art shows to music to plays to festival organizing and creating festivals and
I don't know
world music.
Yeah, the world music thing I was always,
you know, collaborating with, you know, people like Selena before anyone in America knew who Selena was and shit like that.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, just kind of mind-boggling creative presence, you know. It's second to none, I think, you know, in terms of, and it's fitting and makes a lot of sense, frankly, that my dad and him connected so well, because they're just kind of like, their brains are on this unique plane, Yeah.
Like, yeah.
But when he wrote that essay, man, and I was just like floored by it. I asked him if he had written, you know, if he would write this essay, and said sure, you know. And man, pretty cool. And he had followed me around and seen a lot of my shows and done this, you know, blog, and always kind of wrote reviews like, yeah, it's just at Bale's show in LA or wherever, you know.
How awesome.
And so that, I mean, he's been very supportive, and he's the kind of person that's so observant and so gracious with his time and generosity, especially with young artists and just with all people that I've noticed. You know, he's just very unaffected.
Isn't he
by,
like, from Baltimore or something?
I think he is originally. Like, yeah. Yeah. But he's been a New Yorker for so long.
Yeah.
You know, it's like see CBGBs and shit of him, you know, tearing it up in the early 70s. It's like,
do you have recorded music? I meant to ask you that before because I want some to
I've
play
done
on the show.
So many demos and whatnot, but I do have some that are pretty
played?
Cool. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I'll get some.
I'm trying to think. The last time I saw you play was at the gallery with John D.
Yeah.
You and John D.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago. Are you playing at all now?
I'm wanting to do, I've written some new songs and I really want to record them. And do a record. And I always want to put a band together. If I'm not in a band, I'm always wanting to do one, you know.
What's the best band you've ever put together? I remember Clown Meat. Of course you do. You were
man, as a band, probably Clown Meat was great because there was a chemistry there.
Yeah.
In the core of it, with Jana. And
what's Jana doing these days?
Jana is over at Cobra, where I used to live, man.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And she's working on, and this is Jana Johnson, who's so talented.
Yeah, so talented. So cool, too.
Amazing writer.
And,
but she, and super talented actress and singer. You
really?
Know, it's like,
yeah.
You know, who would have known, you know?
Yeah.
But she is working at some company, I wish I knew the name of it, but they do rescue pods for, disaster relief scenarios.
You know,
like, had this company existed when, you know, Katrina. New Orleans happened, it would have been amazing, you know, because, but they're real small, like 5x5, I don't know what dimensions are, but they're portable, self-sufficient living domes.
Wow.
You know?
That's awesome.
And they're being made 100% in Austin, some company, and she's the vice president of it.
Wow.
So she's super excited about it.
That's great.
And I wish I knew the name.
She was part of that class of 91 group of people.
Yeah, man. Jana Johnson.
Jana Johnson.
Jana Johnson.
I remember.
That was the greatest band, probably, man, that I was in.
Yeah. Didn't you guys played at Continental Club?
We played everywhere, man. And our motto was we open for no one. So we'd have every headliner in town.
Clown Meat opens for no one. Yeah, I remember that. I totally remember that.
And Dave Hickey, actually, the art critic, Dave Hickey, who's going to be in town Wednesday at the Ransom Center with Ed Ruscha talking about art.
Oh, really?
But Dave is the one who came up with the name Clown Meat.
That's a great name.
He's like, dude, I have a great name for a band. So what is it, Dave? He's like, Clown Meat. I was like, you know I'm going to steal that. I think a week later, Charles and I started jamming, and we're like, we booked a gig.
Charles.
Diane's birthday bash at the Continental.
Yeah.
And we said, I booked that. I said, we're going to play.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a band. We just had, I had a conceptual band. Which I have one with Stephen Barber right now, a conceptual band called Frognog.
Oh, that's good.
Two of us have a band.
What's Frognog going to be?
Frognog is, who knows, it probably remain conceptual forever.
Like Thug Dog.
And Thug Dog, we have a band too,
band,
don't
yeah.
we?
It's a conceptual band, you, me, and Kyle Crushem.
Now, we need to make that thing happen.
We do need to make that happen.
Shit.
We can
Because that could be good.
Yeah, we can do it. Kyle just had twins.
I know, man.
Unbelievable, huh?
That is wild.
Time flies.
I know. It seems like I blinked. He got married. Now he's got twins.
Now he's got twins.
Pretty cool.
And do you have a date for marriage?
Not yet, but this year, soon.
Okay.
Soon. We're toying with the idea of just going off and hitting a courthouse. And
you guys have been traveling. I mean, you went to Marfa, you went to
New York. We share a little place in New York, actually, with Stephen Barber. Okay. And Allison is, she's been with Ford models for 20-something years.
Jesus, she's still working?
From age 17. Yeah, she's getting ready to go to India in 2 weeks. She's going to Mumbai for a French magazine.
How do you be a model for 20 years? That doesn't seem sustainable.
It's amazing what she's done, you know? And you need to get her on your show.
Yeah, I would love to have her on my show.
Her career is like, it's rare. Very, very, very rare. And she had a full ride at Baylor or something, you know, ready to go to Baylor in the dorm. Her whole family was Baylor, you know? So she was going to go that path and went to New York. And her dad said, look, you could do this for 1 year. If it doesn't work out, come back and I'll pay for your school. And come on, let's do this or whatever, you know?
Yeah. So then we do dad's plan.
And then it was like, it was her plan and went to New York. Boom, sent her to Milan. Boom, sent her all over the world. You know, and at the end of that year, it's just like, this is working out, you know, it's probably made more money than, you know.
Yeah, I bet she's to be able to stay doing that for so long, you have to have some sort of sense of self and not like a total quote unquote model about everything. You know what I mean?
My perception of a model
gotta be smart.
Was shattered when I met her
in
a great way.
Yeah.
Because her personality, like she gets rebooked just about every client she works for.
Yeah.
She gets rebooked again. And then she'll, her work ethic is the type that, a lot of models have, they won't work for under X amount a day or they won't do a certain type of job. She realized early on, it had some great advice, you know, that you should just take everything, you know. Yeah. And so half-day jobs, in-between jobs, filler jobs, over the course of 20 years, do the math.
Yeah.
That's a shitload of extra money.
Yeah.
Instead of just sitting around being like, I want this.
Yeah, I'll only do polo or whatever.
And it's and she's done it all, you know, but she's also done, you know, those lower-end jobs that pay one-fourth or whatever on a half-day where she'd be sitting on her ass. Otherwise, she's like, let's go. So she had a 401k at age 17 and set herself up for life. And now she's writing a book about it. And that's what you need to talk
to. Yeah, I would love to have her on.
But life is good. We did an art show together called Get Lost. And we did this up in Waxahachie at Bruce and Julie Webb's gallery up there, the Webb Gallery. And it was all different momentum, different objects and stuff that are symbolic of experiences we've had through our travels. And basically there was a bed in the middle that's like a queen bed that's handmade bedding of a drop cloth that I've had with me for like 30 years, you know, and Allison hand-stitched pillow shams and everything.
Wow.
And it's an old rusty bed. And then on the pillow heads, it says Get Lost in pink neon. So that bed's kind of juxtaposed in the middle of the, you know, space. And then we have like our dirty sheets, you know, literally framed in a shadow box from our
queen bed. I saw that too.
Bed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just, I guess if you look online, you can see some of the Get Lost stuff too. But just, it's really amazing to work with
your partner
creatively.
Yeah.
And we both want to do a lot more of it. And
that's good.
In fact, when we were in Marfa, we have all the photos for it, but we have a cat named Minnie.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're doing a kid's book called Minnie Goes to Marfa.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we took Minnie around, held her up. We had the iPad. She held her. I was like, get her higher. And we took all these spots, like the grocery store, the Shark, you know, everywhere in town. Cosmico, Minnie does some Marfa lights. Minnie goes to the jailhouse.
You know?
And so we're that's our latest.
That's awesome. So. Hey, is Dave Beebe the mayor out there? Or no, what is he? Is he the city council guy?
Oh, shit.
Remember?
I'm not sure, man. I don't know.
Do you remember him from Banana Blender Surprise?
No,
singer
man.
Singer guy, kind of looked like Buddy Holly.
Wow.
He moved out there a while back.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And what's the... There's a place out there where people play. I'm drawing a blank on it. I've never played there.
Padres.
Padres. He runs Padres.
Oh, does he?
And I think he's a city council person.
Shit, all
or
right.
Maybe he ran for mayor or something.
Yeah, we were there and thinking we were going to escape Austin. And sure as shit, we're there New Year's. And it's like, you know, Jimmy Dale and Butch are playing Padres. And every half the people in town are from Austin.
Yeah.
So we stayed home. We stayed home.
Did you, you played that family Christmas show was that the Welch's Christmas show?
Yeah.
Okay. And then they had all the other people have
Willie
families.
Graham organized that thing, and this is the third annual.
I feel like he's going to be organizing everything
for
the
man,
next 25 like, years.
I know, it's like, someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
But he's you know, doing a great, great job. That thing was so, just the idea of it's really great during Christmas to have. You know, four or five different families and, you know, multiple generations.
It's interesting
performing.
There were even families missing that weren't able to do it. That,
oh, yeah.
Like, there's a lot of you.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, Charlie was there, and Charlie and Will, you know, would have been up there and should have been up there. And Ian was there with Jolene and his kids, and Ian could have been up there and should have been up there. And, you know, it's just like half the audience. That's that is Austin. It's like there's a bunch of on any given night, there's as many people in the audience as there are on stage that are very capable of being on stage.
Yeah. I thought you meant at shows there's just as many people in the audience.
Yeah, well,
which
that,
is true a lot
at
of
my
the time.
Shows. Okay.
You know what else? Here's another great memory that I have from summer of 91. I was going to move here, and I can't remember if it was like on a Saturday or something, but I talked to Will on the phone. He was like, are you crazy? Tomorrow's my birthday. You got to move here tomorrow and then come to the 311 Club. And so I did, because I moved into the Congress House. So I moved up here, unloaded my stuff.
That's right.
And then went to the 311 Club, and you did a backflip.
Oh, my God, dude.
You did a backflip, and then when I went to pee... The guy that was in Slacker, but also in Miller's Crossing. What's that dude's name? He's an actor that lives here. Freaky dude. You know who I'm talking about? Older guy with like crazy teeth. He was there. He was
that man.
He was like at the urinal next to me, and like I did a total like, oh my God! Like, what are you doing here? But I didn't realize he lived here.
Yeah, man. Well, that kind of describes Austin for you.
Yeah.
That part of Austin's still here, except for me doing backflips.
Yeah, you can't do it anymore.
But where you go to the toilet stall and you're like, I recognize that dude from, you know.
I once helped Dennis Quaid out of a toilet stall.
You're like,
at the end of the night at Antone's. Yes. I had met him upstairs before and he was having some difficulty
getting out of the toilet stall.
Dude. And I was washing my hands and I was like, oh, let me help you out. And I helped him find his people.
Oh, shit, man.
Crazy times. So that show was good that you guys played, that show at Strange Brew with all the families?
Man, really, really great. And my dad was in town, which was always nice, you know, and Buck and I and crew, you know, Buck is dancing. And
that's awesome.
My kids were both out of town. But
But
otherwise, I would have had them play because Sled, my oldest, is a great songwriter,
really
great drummer.
Does he have aspirations to be artistic?
You know, I think he'll always have a little bit of that creative need, you know, but I don't know that that'll be a career for him, you know, but he's, and Calder is really, really into acting right now and doing like this competitive acting at his school. So they spend the whole year working on a play and then they go and compete against other schools
one like a plays. UIL thing.
Yeah. And I so he's doing that now. And he's gotten some lead roles in the school plays
really?
When he was younger.
I wonder what kind of plays are they doing now? Because, like, I mean, I did a UIL
thing. They did one
thing.
Called Stone Soup, and then they did.
They're doing
Fiddler on the Roof, which was actually.
Oh wow!
And he played Perchik, and it was great. It was actually a great production. Man, it's like
that's awesome
at Trinity Episcopal School. And, man, they have a pretty good theater department for. You know, it only goes up to eighth grade, so it's fifth through eighth graders that are doing the plays.
Right.
And they do music, they do the production, they do the sets.
It's amazing.
And they have a kick-ass theater. You're like, what? you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Who paid for this?
I saw this.
They're using it.
Did you see the thing that they have over in Mueller, this theater that they just reached, that AISD thing?
They're going to do, a lot of high school plays there, and they do auditions there.
I've never been inside, but it's gorgeous outside.
Yeah, it's cool.
So, all right. We've been going on for a long time, but listen, if people, I love talking to you, and this might actually, I don't think I've ever said this, but this might be my very favorite one I've done, because I've known you for a long time. There's some stuff I didn't know. There's some stuff I've always wanted to say, but we don't
do
see each other enough.
Hours.
Yeah,
and we should.
We can do it
just
again.
Just not with the mics on.
Yeah, definitely. But if people want to find out about your work, find out where to find your work, they can go to BaleCreekAllen.com. And find all your stuff there.
Yeah, and to have them look for possible gallery over at Canopy.
Okay, you probably post that on your site then.
Start looking for that too. So,
what's the name of the gallery going to be?
I don't. It's so new. I don't even know yet.
Okay. Well, when you find out, let me know, and I'll direct people. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Right. Thanks, bro.
You're an amazing dude.
Thanks, man.
Great conversation with Bale Creek Allen. I love that guy, man. He's one of my favorite artists and one of my favorite dudes. A true artist, no matter what the medium is, he is creating. That's just a creative entity and just a total joy to be around. Bale Creek Allen, look him up at BaleCreekAllen.com. Get into his stuff. Find out when you can see a show. See if you can pick up one of his pieces if you are an art person. I love that guy. All right, so while you're out there checking out Bale Creek Allen, don't forget that you can like our Facebook page. Like it. Get out there, and you'll be finding out when new shows are coming up, see pictures of folks like me and Bale Allen, all kinds of things. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and on your iPhone podcast app. You can find us on Stitcher if you don't want to fill up your podcast or fill up your phone with all your podcasts. You can stream them with Stitcher. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. All right? Hey, thank you to Bale for coming by. Love that guy. Check out his art, BaleCreekAllen.com. Everybody, have a great weekend, all right? And don't forget, I'm playing on Wednesday, February 10th at the Townsend. If you're in Austin, we play 8 to 10. It's me, Tom Meaney, and Sila Misra in a songwriter circle with the great John Green playing percussion with all of us, all right? Have a great weekend. Enjoy yourselves. Maybe I'll see you at Mardi Gras in Galveston with Skyrocket. Wave at me. Oh, show me your beads. All right, have a great weekend. Let's get down.